The year is 2021. It is no longer safe to transmit information. Phones, computers, and satellites are all vulnerable. But there is a solution.
Your storage capacity?
I can carry nearly 80 gigs of data in my head.
Input the data into the brain of a human courier like Johnny Mnemonic.
Hit me.
Now, in a future...
We locked on him.
...where those who control the information control the world.
I've been charged with recovering the head of the Mnemonic Courier.
Everyone wants what is stored in Johnny's head.
Double cheese anchovies?
Welcome to Deciphering Johnny Mnemonic. Oh my God, I said it right the first time. How about that, you guys?
Yeah.
The over-under on the number of times I mispronounce that word in this podcast is probably 15 at least.
Mnemonic.
Yeah, I know. Not an easy word to read or pronounce. Zoe Lindsay is here. Pete Baker is here. It's been a while since we've all gotten together to do a movie podcast.
Yeah, what's new? It's November 6th. What's up with you?
Feeling good.
It's been a slow week. I'm glad we had something to keep us busy, you know?
I know. I've kind of been sticking my head in the sand, honestly, for the last 48 hours because I just can't, like, I just hit a wall. Couldn't do it. Like, you know, there was nothing I could read that wasn't making me mad. So
I have Steve Kornacki up in the corner of the screen just right now, just so you know. sorry if I space out at some point.
The best tweet I've seen in the last few days that sums it all up is from the same year that brought you 6 months of April. Welcome to Tuesday, part four.
Highly accurate. Yeah,
actually, that's a good segue into this movie. It's a little bit of production notes to lead it off. This movie is set in January 2021, which we may not be far off from this world. Yeah. We have more Wi-Fi than they thought we would, but otherwise it's a hellscape. That's pretty fitting.
And less VCRs.
Yeah. certainly less tape based things, generally. But this is another one of those like short stories from a magazine. It was actually William Gibson that wrote it, which is cool. You know, responsible for Necromancer and all kinds of other good stuff. And this movie, apparently. But mercifully, it's only an hour and a half long. So,
yeah.
But I did look a little bit into like the production. I was like looking at the, you know, cinematographer and some of the down credit stuff. This one was directed by Robert Longo, who I had never heard of. Another in a long line of music video directors that tried to make the jump and then never made another movie. After that, he was prior to Johnny Mnemonic. He was known for one Megadeth video and a Helmet video, and a couple REM like side videos.
Yeah,
and being a punk performer, which I'm guessing is how he got connected with Henry Rollins. Because I looked it up, and Henry Rollins' only other like major credit before this was The Chase with Charlie Sheen,
which he was great in.
Yeah.
Rollins was great in The Chase. God.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time. I didn't even realize he was in that.
Yeah, he's great.
That's weird because I growing up in DC, like that whole hardcore punk scene was going on at the time that I was in high school. So like I knew who Henry Rollins was from Black Flag. And then when he started showing up in movies in the 90s, I was like, wait, is this the same guy? That was like, you know, throwing chairs at the audience, you know, 10 years ago. And like, and
now he's wearing chunky teacher glasses and trying to be all button up.
He's like the flunky for some investment banker in Heat. Like, what's happening here? We need to get to that too at some point.
But, there's a lot to talk about the cast in this movie. But one other production note, the cinematography is handled by this guy, Francois Pertot, who is primarily known for Weekend at Bernie's. If that tells you something about the leap in stylistic adjustments that were made to go from Weekend at Bernie's to cyberpunk, modem punk, Johnny Mnemonic.
That's kind of, yeah. Let's maybe start with the cast because I had not seen this movie before we decided to do it for the podcast. So I sat down and watched it a few times, and we were originally going to do this a couple weeks ago, but I remember when I sat down and watched it, one, I was excited that it was only like 90 minutes. I was like, okay, good. This is a tight running time. I like that. And then I started looking at the cast. I was like, wait a second. How did they get Keanu Reeves, Dina Meyer, who I guess wasn't really a star then.
This was Starship Troopers. So
right. And Dragonheart, I guess. Dolph Lundgren, who comes in off the top rope, like halfway through this movie.
Just cybernetic Jesus or something.
Jesus time.
Incredible. Yeah. Like just going for it in every single scene, like not even pretending that he's there to do anything but get a paycheck and like chew scenery.
I wrote in my notes that he is swinging for the state line in this movie. Just
he really is. I don't like after Rocky IV, he did a few like of those like 80s action movies, but then I don't remember seeing him too much in the 90s. And I did not see this at the time it came out, obviously, so I didn't even know he was in this. But you just get him as this like wild-eyed like cult street preacher. I think his character's name is literally Street Preacher.
Yeah.
And he's just like absolutely, you know, going bananas through the whole thing.
And he runs the what was it? The Church of the Retransfiguration. So his whole sort of religious theocracy is built around like modifying your body as a sort of cybernetic enhancements and stuff. And like, we're all going to be made better and closer to God through technology. So better living through enhanced musculature, I guess.
So before we go into the plot of this, because the first 10 minutes of that 90 minutes is cue cards at the top of the movie, giving you the setup. I want to make my like hot take bold stance that I'm always of the opinion that they should remake good concepts that were crappy movies instead of remaking good movies and not living up to the original. And I think that this is a prime candidate for that because the art direction in this movie, I honestly genuinely loved it, cheesiness and all. And I think that like if it hadn't been hacked up in script, if it had had a more experienced director, if it hadn't been revised by committee to death, like I think it could be like up there with Blade Runner in terms of cyberpunk cinema. There's so much of the core of that genre. I mean, obviously it's a Gibson story. There's so much of the core of that story, and there's so much good world building and absurd world building, but like, there's so much good world building in it that this could have been a great movie.
Yeah. And I kind of loved that it was like, it's 20 years on from when the movie was actually made, but it's based on technology that was in the vanguard the year it was made. It was like everything stopped and we're still using mini discs and tape deck hard drives and no Wi-Fi, no fiber. Like it's all, you know, like frozen in amber. And now we're building, you know, a sneaker net. Literally, you know, transporting physically data because there's no better way to do that 20 years later. And it becomes like this modem grunge world that feels, like you said, Zoe, feels rich, feels full. Like there's a lot there that I'm glad it wasn't a 3-hour movie to try to, you know, plumb those depths, but there's clearly something there.
Well, that's the funny thing. If you read some of the research on like the making of the movie, so it was based on, as you mentioned, Pete, a Gibson short story, and he wrote the script too. And originally it was supposed to be like $1.5 million budget, small movie, you know, kind of art house, like, you know, 90s indie film, but they couldn't get $1.5 million. So they ended up getting $30 million from somebody else. And this is how you end up with like a big studio.
That's one of the best Hollywood stories ever. It's like, we couldn't get $1.5 million for the art house picture, so we got $30 million for this shitty blockbuster.
Yeah, it's the Hollywood version of, I'm sorry this letter is so long, I didn't have time to write you a short one, you know?
Right.
But you're right about the whole revision by committee thing too. I think Zoe is, you can see the seams in a lot of the places in the movie. Like there's a very cool, tight, probably like 70 minute cyberpunk story in there. Mm-hmm. And then there's like also a Hong Kong like gangster movie in there. With some cool, like, you know, proto John Wick type stuff happening. And then there's like a weird social commentary movie in there too, with like creepy religious overtones where you're just like, wait, where did this come from? And like, right. What is Ice-T doing in here? As like a, his character really reminded me of the Lawrence Fishburne character in the later John Wick movie. I think it's the second John Wick movie where he's like kind of a homeless, you know, yeah, where he's just like has this army of the night type thing that like is just out there, you know, doing whatever it is they're doing, you know, for revenge or whatever it happens to be.
So we should now 15 minutes into this podcast, we should, you know, give an idea of what this movie is about. Besides the absurdity of all the other parts. So
which one of us wants to take a swing at that?
Well, I mean, we can start by just reading the prologue that starts at the on the title card. Yeah. In the second decade of the 21st century, corporations rule. Tracks. The world is threatened by a new plague, NAS, nerve attenuation syndrome. Fatal epidemic, its cause and cure are unknown. The corporations are opposed by the low-techs, a resistance movement risen from the streets. Hackers, data pirates, guerrilla fighters in the info wars. The corporations defend themselves. And then, you know, for the fuller plot synopsis, there's Johnny Mnemonic is basically a data trafficker. He's undergone surgery to have a data storage system in his head, because there's no better way to move data than wetware, I guess. it allows him to store digital data too sensitive to risk transmission on computer networks because encryption doesn't happen in the 90s. It's locked by a password, like a series of images. And he's unaware of the contents and he can't retrieve them himself. And he makes a modest living in this like sprawling sort of urban world by physically transporting the information for corporations and crime rings and all that stuff. And eventually in this movie, he's overloaded with information that he has not gotten the sufficient upgrades to his brain to store. He's apparently like most humans can store 80 gigabytes. He got upgraded to 160, but his clients need 320 gigabytes of storage in his head, and it's giving him a headache.
I did enjoy that you can kind of overdraft on storage, but there's like the late fees are just awful.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk about data seepage, which really made me uncomfortable.
Yeah, where is it leaking? Like,
I didn't want to hear about it. Like, there was way too much of that in there for me. But you kind of get the sense that there's a whole network of guys like him, right? Like, or this is their job in the same way that you get that sense in the John Wick world,
like the transporter. More,
yeah, right. Like there's some sort of underground group of people that this is their living. They, you know, fly to Tokyo, get uploaded with this stuff and fly back to Newark. God help them. Mm.
So he gets this massive amount of data dumped into his brain. Yeah. Got to work it in. Yeah. And of course, immediately shadowy people show up trying to kill him from Pharmacom, a massive pharmaceutical company. And so then Johnny is on the run, quickly runs into Jane, right? Was her name in the movie, who has been genetically modified for superhuman fast reflexes and basically to be like a freelance bodyguard class. Like if this was an RPG, basically what she is. So then they first go see Henry Rollins, who is trying his best to do a subtle nerd voice with his big birth control glasses on. And then they try and take the stuff out of his head. That doesn't work. They have to go call in the big guns, which is Ice-T's friend Jones, a Navy-enhanced cybernetic dolphin code hacker.
Clairvoyant.
Who, by the way, missing detail in the book was addicted to heroin. And so that was how they got his help was they brought him a package of smack.
Yep.
What? That's a real thing?
Yep.
Oh my God.
Dolphin won't help unless you help him. You got to help him chase the dragon if you want to get that data out of your head.
I had to say, like, as absurd as this movie gets, that the dolphin doesn't come in until like 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through.
Yeah.
And it's just in the background in like a tank, and it has like headphones on and like all kinds of weird shit going on. I said out loud, like in my basement watching this by myself, I was like, what the fuck did I just do? And I'm just like, how could this be possible? In what world did somebody like write this into the script? And they're like, or I mean, if it was in the original short story, then I mean, I don't know. It's like,
yeah, there was more to him in the short story. He had a whole backstory. It was like straight out of Dune, like the clairvoyant future. I forget what the ship steer ship pilots were in Dune, but they were in these like vats of stuff, and same deal. Like they ate all the spice, and it let them see in the future.
Oh my God!
I think dolphins were just kind of a thing for sci-fi around that time, because also, because I'm a giant nerd, Star Trek, The Next Generation, right, a few years later, makes several mentions to cetacean ops, the idea that they had this whole area of aquatic crewmen that were responsible for spatial navigation because they were very used to navigating in multiple
axes. So it got that whole sonar thing going on. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I didn't even know that. Well, yeah, obviously. They don't have an electoral college.
Yeah.
Clearly smarter than we are. There's some pretty, I looked up the review of this by Roger Ebert, just because I thought he might have some pretty hilarious thoughts on it. I just want to read a couple lines from this. This is the opening of his review from May 26, 1995. He says, Johnny Mnemonic is one of the great goofy gestures of recent cinema, a movie that doesn't deserve one nanosecond of serious analysis, but has a kind of idiotic grandeur that makes you almost forgive it. That's some high quality stuff,
yeah.
Roger. And then, Pete, to your point about the technology part of it, he kind of walks through like the whole thing of, you know, sticking the data in Keanu Reeves's head. And then he says, as a method of data transfer, this stinks. Even today, it would be faster, easier, and safer to encrypt the data and send it by modem. And by Johnny Mnemonic's time, the world will be wired with fiber optic cables, allowing enormous files to be squirted around the world in seconds.
I was right there with Roger Ebert until he said squirted.
Yeah, uh-huh. we're still working out the data around.
Yeah,
that did kind of stop me. I don't know how much Roger knew about the way technology worked in 1995, yeah. But he's
thank God that's not how we're still talking about data being transferred. Let me squirt you an email real quick.
Squirt and
don't think I'm not adopting that, because I am.
I definitely want to talk about how they encrypt things in this movie.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That kind of hit me, and you mentioned it earlier, Pete, about like, you know, wouldn't it just be easier to just encrypt this and, you know, send it or whatever. And this is right in the middle of like the clipper chip first crypto wars era, you know, 94, 95. That was right when the NSA and the federal government was trying to backdoor every part of encryption, and succeeded in some ways. But, you know, here we are kind of in the middle of the second one, you know, 25 years later.
So the way that they encrypt the data when they're stuffing all of this into Johnny's head is they give a remote control to the client and tell them to press freeze frame three times through channel surfing. So they're hopping around on TV and they press the button to generate three random screenshots, which they then are going to fax. And presumably when shown to Johnny at the right time, this is going to unlock the data. And of course, people show up and start shooting. And so only half of this data gets transmitted by fax. Johnny ends up with part of the hard copy that gets torn off. And so my first thought was like, at first I was like, well, this is an interesting idea of getting like a really complex amount of data to use as a key, right? Like this isn't that different from like jiggling a mouse or something, but it's not really random. And so if this is a thing that people in this universe do, like if I was a hacker, I would have a DVR recording 24/7. And as long as I know the rough time that something is sent, you know, I narrow it down to a 5-minute window and I can run, you know, frame by frame combination attacks to try and unlock this. I'm surprised that they never ended up trying that, because it seemed like they were going to do that when Jones starts going to crack it.
Well, yeah, not to mention the data that they were putting in Johnny's head came off like a little 2.5-inch optical disc. Yeah. That would have been, seems like would have been pretty easy to conceal and, right. and get somewhere. If they're going to send this guy, you know, with this stuff in his head, like I'm pretty sure that disc would have fit up his butt. Like, come on, like there's better ways to do this that don't require all these hoops.
Have you never seen a prison movie?
It probably would have been more efficient for him to have a physical cavity in his head that they just put that stick into.
No kidding.
Honestly, because then you don't worry about seepage and there's no squirting. No squirting involved. I did enjoy that encryption scheme. I had to kind of run that back a couple times and like make sure I understood the whatever flawed logic of what they were using, but it's not. It's kind of clever, like that idea of like the little, you know, way to get some entropy and like figure this out.
Although Zoe, if it really did, I can't imagine the DVRing would work if they're going to this much trouble over 300 gigabytes.
True.
Like how storage is a premium. Like if you're trying That's to record true. Channels all day long just for the encryption keys, you're going to be in your own.
You'd have to have a whole army to carry around your Plex library.
As opposed to the server farm that Pete has.
Right.
Even this wouldn't fit in my head either.
No. It is fun to like go back and see where the ceiling on technology was there. I mean, the reliance on fax machines, even in 1995.
Yeah.
Seems kind of silly, although if you've had to buy a house anytime in the last few years, you know that you still have to fax a bunch of shit to a mortgage company in a lot of cases.
It's true. The default storage level that everyone has in their heads is just barely bigger than the Blu-ray copy of this movie. Like everyone's got 80 gigabytes, and I'm pretty sure a rip of this would have been right around 60. So you're only keeping so much stuff in your head those days.
Do we ever get any kind of explanation for why this job exists? Like they don't ever really delve into that. Like why we can't just fax this information, for example, or like, I mean, data encryption.
They just say it's too sensitive. Yeah. They wave their hands. It's too sensitive. Encryption. I mean, when you've got fucking clairvoyant dolphins around, like are you going to trust encryption? Like, no,
no.
Certainly the Yakuza see right through that shit.
It is a very extreme case of security by obscurity.
Especially if that junkie dolphin cleans up, man, he's gonna be the most powerful being in the universe. Can't
it's be telling tales. Yeah, you don't want that. You don't want that.
So,
at all.
So they get away from the situation. Then I made a note. Oof, this virus rock song. I think they tried to do an original cyberpunk track. Whew, it was rough. Yeah,
that was a Rollins song.
Sure was.
Oh, but before that, when he got all this data, you know, there's a whole like subplot. Part of why he's getting this this seepage in his brain is he upgraded. He used RAM doubler on his head, and we all know RAM doubler is not really doubling your RAM, right? It's a specious technology, and it's not working. I can't believe it. I love that RAM doubler became a major plot point of a Keanu Reeves.
It was funny. Poster.
I think they were using Pied Piper's middle-out encryption technology there.
Sounds right.
As long as I don't have to see the visual on that one from the whiteboard drawing. Yeah.
So we get into some of the worst action movie quips I've ever heard in my life. I want you to do something for me. Die!
Yep.
Actual line of dialogue delivered by a paid actor in this film.
It's written by
when his prostitute earlier in the hotel says, "Where is home, Johnny?" He's like, "Home? Would you believe I don't even know?"
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's some bad. And imagine that being delivered by Keanu Reeves. It's just bad.
It's so good. And there's a few other gems in here, like your smuggler in your head. Sure.
I used to have a summer job breaking and entering.
Mm-hmm. Not bad.
Yeah. Although this movie also has one of the most animated Keanu Reeves performances I've ever seen when he has his breakdown and demands room service and shirt laundering.
I love that. That I never felt like more in tune with a character than by that point. Like towards the end of the movie, he's on the ropes, like things aren't going his way, and he finally just can't deal anymore, and he climbs up on a trash heap and just starts yelling about how dirty his clothes are, and he wants room service, and yeah. I want my suit laundered, and he's on the verge of tears and just can't deal. I mean that really resonated with me. I just want room service. I just want my clothes laundered. I just want to go to the Palace Hotel and relax too.
I've certainly felt that way after coming off long flights, back when flying was a thing, where you're just like, oh my God.
Clutching at his suit. Like, I just want my shirt laundered. Yeah. Like, where is this coming from? Like,
you just, that was like one of the
weirdest things. I mean, he, as a protagonist in this movie, there is so little that you care about him. Like, there's just nothing there. Yeah. He's just, it's kind of perfect with what his job is. He is an empty vessel in this movie. They're just like, fill him up with data and try to get him somewhere. But that's it. It's a plot movement point. Like, he is not, there is no character there.
I wonder if that, I mean, I hadn't thought about that, Pete, but that's a pretty good way of describing the character. And also, that Keanu Reeves at that point in his career, I think people were just like, oh, he's the doofus from Bill and Ted. Like, this would be great.
Speed at that point.
And Speed. Yeah. This is right after Speed, right? Uh-huh. It would have been like maybe 2-3 years right after Speed. And it's a handful of years before The Matrix, which there's a very strong like Matrix vibe in this movie. Like, you can, I don't know much about like how the Wachowskis like came up with the idea or any of that, but I would imagine that they had this thing on in the background like while they were writing.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot of cyberpunk themes obviously in The Matrix, but I think that like I you can't watch Johnny Mnemonic now and not compare it to The Matrix, because it's Keanu Reeves. They're so close together. The Matrix made such an impact, and Johnny Mnemonic, not as much. But like this idea of like physical health tied to mental health and mental fitness, like throughout the movie, Johnny does like these mudras and like meditative rituals to try and like protect against this data seepage. And there's some similarity there to the kind of the training that he ends up doing to go through the simulation in The Matrix.
Yeah, there was like a lot of plot overlap with The Matrix, but a lot of visual graphic overlap with Lawnmower Man, which I think kind of doomed this one to be a real brief window of like, hey, look what we can do with computers. It's like, no, you can't quite yet.
Yeah,
you're really not there yet. That, yeah. When he's getting the data absorbed into his brain and we go on a 3D tour of a bunch of 2D images of data, and we're flying around, and that, we're watching him learn Kung Fu basically from the Matrix. That was right up there with like some of the shittier screensavers I had back in the day.
It's very much like Tron overlapped with like, hey, we got an SGI workstation. We don't really know what to do with it, but we're going to try some stuff.
But we've got it. We rented this thing for 16 hours. What can we do? Five seconds of video. Uh-huh.
I did think that it was neat that like the very dated computer graphics were almost exclusively in the virtual world. Like, that was mostly practical effects. It was animatronics for the dolphin. I think it was rotoscoped for the nanowire murder garrote thing.
Yeah, the laser
the laser wire. Yes.
That was awesome.
Which that was had one of those thumb rings that every goth had in high school.
Yeah. That was definitely the coolest thing in this movie, was the laser whip. That was like a lightsaber on a string. That was pretty badass. But
yeah, that came out of nowhere for me.
Yeah, really did. It seemed really dangerous.
So, Dennis, if the smack addicted cybernetic dolphin uploads the cure to Wi-Fi disease through a VHS tape, is an absurd enough of a story element for you? In the book, Jane Molly ends up beating that dude with the nanowire by getting into a dance fight in a giant acoustic trampoline room. and getting him so disoriented that he cuts himself and then falls through a hole to his death.
Oh my God.
How did that not make it into the movie?
No, that's
got to be in the director's cut.
How did you spend your $30 million budget if you didn't do that scene? What are you doing? How much could the dolphin have wanted for this movie? I mean, come on. Ice-T couldn't have cost that much.
So the other kind of cool like subtext or subplot to all of this was the resistance side of things, like J-Bone, Ice-T's character, J-Bone, kind of ran this like, I mean, they called themselves low-techs, but they were fully invested in a lot of technology, but they kind of, they held up the sort of Luddite side of things where, you know, the rest of the world is overwhelmed with technology and they're the scrappers and, you know, they're like satellite pirates and stuff. They're hacking into TV broadcasts and trying to get people to expand their mind, like snatch back your brain, zombie, snatch it back and hold it is like their line they keep throwing out on the TV. Which I don't know, it didn't really land that well because Ice-T is just not a competent actor, but I thought there was something pretty cool to that too. That's where a lot of the Matrix vibes came from me, where it's like, you're not even aware of what's going on here, man.
That's what I kind of wanted, even though, especially in 1995, Ice-T was not exactly, you know, an Oscar winning actor. He was, you know, he was in a lot of action movies in that period, like Ricochet and Trespass and stuff like that. So he's turned into it. He's on like every SVU or NCIS or Law and Order, whatever those shows are. He's all over the place. But I would have definitely liked, they could have given me 5 more minutes of like Ice-T's crew and what they're doing like all the time. Like there's some stuff there that I think could have been interesting, you know, because that's, when he meets up with like the street preacher and like Ice-T could barely like conceal his like, what the fuck am I doing in this movie type thing. You know, he's clearly just like, you got to, what am I getting paid? Like, you know, you can just see the dollar signs in his eyes. Like, this is wild.
We need to talk about Dolph Lundgren in this movie because.
Yeah, I would very much like to do that.
So I was reading the article background. One of the things that jumped out immediately is that the director and William Gibson did not want him in this movie. They said he showed up with his acting coach, who was wearing a cape and a walking stick. And they were like, just get rid of him. And so they wrote the street preacher part, which you can completely take out of the story with like almost no consequences.
Yeah,
and they invented that character. And in 2016, when they were doing a retrospective article, Longo said, "Yeah, we've been thinking about doing an anniversary 45-minute cut without the street preacher."
Did you?
I would watch that.
Zoe, did you see who they almost got to play the street preacher?
No.
Bono.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't.
I'm
know
not
that
sure.
Would be, yeah.
I'm not sure if that would have been worse. I don't know.
I mean, Bono spent the last 40 years preaching at all of us, so it would have been pretty fitting, you know? Yeah. So Lundgren, at this point, he had been in a bunch of, like I said earlier, a bunch of kind of goofy action movies after Rocky IV. He was in the Masters of the Universe movie as He-Man, which I had forgotten all about. And then he was in the original Punisher movie in 89. But then he was kind of like just doing that kind of junk between between Rocky IV and Johnny Mnemonic. But the dude has been, his IMDb is full. Like he never stopped working. I guess I just hadn't seen him in a lot of stuff. And now he's turned into like this kind of sage. I had no idea that he's like a legitimate genius until the last couple of years.
The guy, chemical engineering.
Incredible.
Like, not just a smart actor, like legitimate genius, like it was either a Rhodes scholarship or some crazy fellowship. Like dude is legit. And then went on to become Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah, it's just unreal.
Henry Rollins said that during one of the stunt scenes where Street Preacher and Spider are facing off, that Lundgren accidentally hit him. He said it was like a UPS delivery truck. My DNA uncoiled. I found a new religion. He hit me so hard and it just stopped. My head took the entirety of the weight. I was like, wow, my thinking is 20% slower. I'm going to run for office.
Wow. That's a good Rollins line.
There's like a legendary story about the shooting of Rocky IV where they had to stop filming that movie for like a week because he put Stallone in the hospital. Like he hit him and Stallone's heart expanded. Like there was all this fluid around it. And Stallone had to be flown from like Vancouver down to LA to like, because it was Stallone's idea. He's like, hey, we should really hit each other in this fight scene. And Lundgren's like, all right, cool.
He's like, no, no, please don't.
Yeah, that's it. Never I'm again. Done. Yeah. I'm supposed to win this fight in this movie. But yeah, he's the casting. I wonder, like, some of the what ifs, like, you know, obviously the Bono thing, but apparently the way that they got Keanu Reeves is somebody just dropped this script on his doorstep, like literally dropped the bag on his doorstep, and he was just intrigued enough to like pick it up and read it, which, as I understand, Hollywood is not usually how it happens. I don't know that much about it, but imagine a time when you could just
go. That's how it happens in Keanu world, Hollywood.
I think so. Yeah. You could just go to like, although I'm not rolling up to John Wick's house, and bad things happen when you do that.
He's the nicest guy in the world. There was I did see one good review or one article about this that was talking about just Keanu Reeves in it at the time, mm-hmm. and partly how bad he was in it, but nobody really cared because nobody expects much of Keanu Reeves, and everyone just, you know, enjoys him. And the great quote was, to this day, Reeves conducts himself as if he's a boulder in a stream. The world crashes around him like water, and he remains steadfast and always in his own essence. And that was pretty much him in this movie. Just,
wow.
I'm on camera, and it's going to keep pointing at me, and I'm going to deliver these lines, and you guys make a movie around me. That's how the production of this went.
What a great way to go through life. Just kind of like let water flow around you and do your thing. He seems like a pretty happy dude. Every interview.
21st century Popeye. I am what I am.
Yeah, pretty much. I do think we should talk about how this thing, it doesn't overlap with the John Wick universe, but there's definitely some kind of indicators of that world building that, which I think we've talked about, or maybe not on the podcast, but amongst ourselves, about how wild it is that John Wick, I certainly thought that movie was from a graphic novel or some book I had never read when I first saw it. But the fact that that was just an original script that, you know, whoever the scriptwriter was pulled out of his brain is incredible. But there's definitely some influence between the John Wick universe and this one. You can see it in like a lot of the kind of, you know, Hong Kong action that goes on in both movies, the highly stylized violence, that kind of stuff. And like it seems to exist in a world that's sort of the real world, but also sort of not. You know, it's got its own economy. It's got its own kind of governance. It's got its own value system and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty wild. I'd love to see kind of another take on this. Like you mentioned, Zoe, like it's a good idea. It was obviously kind of stepped on by a million people, but I wouldn't mind seeing a 2020, you know, remake of this idea.
Well, and I say like, bring Keanu Reeves back. Like there's nothing in the movie, in the book that I'm aware of that really ties Johnny to a specific age or characterization. And especially now that like, I get the sense that Keanu likes doing these kinds of projects because he's also doing Cyberpunk 2077 and like he did The Matrix and like, I'm sure there's more if I were to think about it, but like, let him do that now. I think that would be a great movie.
So there's another whole subplot to this with the Yakuza and the hitman that they, the guy with the laser whip is one of the hitmen, but the real sort of lord of the Yakuza is played by Takashi Kitano, who's like a super well-known Japanese actor that you would immediately recognize from all kinds of movies like this. He shows up in like the last half of the movie. He's like, well, I, you know, I'll have to do it myself, I guess. And so he starts pursuing Johnny Mnemonic, and he's trying to get that data. Turns out, though, towards the end, we find out what the data in his head actually is. And it's one of these corporations that is treating everybody with this neurological syndrome. And what's in Johnny Mnemonic's head is the cure, is the formula for the cure for this.
Right.
But Takashi Kitano's character, who's like motivated by the death of his daughter years before, who died from this NAS syndrome, works for the company that has the cure and won't release it. They're all after Johnny Mnemonic because they don't want this data out there, because it would be a cure for this like Wi-Fi disease that everyone has. And they're making boatloads of money treating it instead. Turns out their main hitman's daughter died of it and would have been saved had they not sat on this data. So now they're, you know, buddies now too, Johnny and Takashi. So all just, it's part of why this movie sort of just goes out with a whimper, because like everybody changes sides like five times, and you don't, there's too many characters. You don't really know anyone's like motivation. I didn't know this guy even had a daughter. I didn't know that was a problem until later when they're like, it's a cure. And they're like, it could have saved my daughter. Like, what daughter? Where did that come from?
Uh-huh. I think the most egregious of those is that they, as they introduce Johnny, like the character note that they give him is that he's desperate to get these jobs done so that he can get a surgery that will restore his childhood memories, which he gave up so that he would have some extra storage room. And then at the end, after they extract this, spoiler alert, they extract this cure from his head, and then all of his memories come flooding back. So I guess that it was just like a cosmetic brain surgery or...
Well, that was also in the terms and conditions of installing RAM doubler, made strike childhood memories.
All your first communion pictures are belong to us.
Remember that beach? Not anymore. But you've got four megs of RAM now.
It was also interesting that like throughout the movie, you know, he doesn't remember his background. They make that a big talking point. But like throughout the whole thing, he's kind of like alluding to the idea that he has this horrible background, right? Like, maybe I don't want to remember. And like just kind of alluding to like, well, I wasn't really giving up anything with these memories. And then at the end, when they come flooding back, I mean, it's like a, you know, it's like a Super 8 home video. It's just like his birthday party and running through a field. So I thought that was interesting, whether that was like just continuity error or if that is like the coping mechanism lie that he's built for himself to adjust to the fact that he has no identity.
It looked like kind of Hallmark cliche childhood memories, like here's some daisies and I'm running through this field, and and here's a birthday party where I was a cowboy or whatever.
He shouldn't be so angsty once he remembers how much of a saccharine cliche childhood he had.
maybe that was Jones's gift, right? He's a clairvoyant gentleman. He can like implant a fake set of memories with that freed up space. It's like giving him the blue pill. It's like, you know,
it's all just dolphins running through fields. the junky dolphins idea of a good child, good human childhood.
This movie I was going to say this movie did predict some technology, though. There were deep fakes in this movie where the hitman is using the image of one of these corpse stooges to talk to Johnny, and he's doing like a hand puppet interface to make the face talk, which was interesting. And then the microwave dish that the dolphin has, I went and looked it up, and the active defense system, which was a real DARPA project for like the heat ray gun, is very much a similar idea. And like that didn't start, I think, until 2004. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah. It's very cool. I kept kind of, every time they mention the dolphin, who's, his name is Jones for, I guess because he's jonesing for heroin. I'm not really sure. But it kept like, I kept flashing to the character in Hunt for Red October, Jonesy, the sonar guy, submarine. Like, for, you know, like I was just like, for whatever reason, I don't know, maybe it was because Sean Connery had just died too. I was just like, I don't know. But
all sonar-based characters have to be named Jones.
Apparently. I like it. I'd sign up for that.
Jones is kind of their man in a van, but he's more like their mammal in a tank, I guess.
Yeah, right. It's just, it's so jarring. I'd love to, like, I would love to see or hear Gibson, like, explain that, like, where this idea for the code-breaking interpretive dolphin came from. I mean, I assume there was quite a lot of psychedelic drugs involved in the writing of this.
Well, so William Gibson was not, so I guess this is one of his first like screenplay. He'd written a lot of the books that became screenplays, but this was one of his first screenplays. And yeah. Sony tried to make a big marketing push out of this online. This was what, 1994, 95. So this was one of the first big like internet marketing pushes. So they did a bunch of advertising, but they also made a like a scavenger hunt online that you could win $20,000 if you got through it. And they had William Gibson giving out some of the clues. William Gibson had never been on the internet before prior to it. Like literally this, the marketing campaign for Johnny Mnemonic was the first time William Gibson, the writer of Johnny Mnemonic, had ever been online. So in a lot of ways, like it makes all this way more impressive, you know, that he's gotten this far without ever being online. Like,
that's I don't have a sense of how, do you guys know how old he is? I have no idea.
William Gibson?
Yeah.
I don't.
No,
I mean, this is 25 years ago. I don't know how old the story was at that point, but
he's 72.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not that old.
So this is 25 years ago. He wrote this in his late 40s or something, probably.
The inventor of cyberpunk did not get online before 1995.
It's kind of wild. Yeah. Jeez. So if we've talked about like an updated version of this, if somebody wanted to do that, I certainly think Keanu could do the lead role again. Who would you guys like to see in the other? I mean, I wouldn't hate seeing Ice-T in his role right now. I mean, he could still do that.
Well, Val Kilmer was originally cast as Johnny. Not sure he could pull it off now, but that could
Val's had a rough go of it the last few years. I'm not sure he's up to it.
I want Jones to actually get some dialogue, especially if it's a clairvoyant dolphin. He can just talk into your head. And I'm thinking like Patton Oswalt. He does really good voiceover work. Or maybe Paul Giamatti. It would be perfect for Jones. Just like done with everything.
Yeah, slightly annoyed at everybody.
Yep.
Just like, fine, I'll break your stupid codes again. Whatever.
So yeah. I think I have the perfect casting for Johnny Mnemonic in the remake. Okay. Right. Hear me out. Justin Long. He needs a redemption tour, and Johnny Mnemonic could be his makeup for Die Hard 4.
Nick Cage is the street preacher.
I can see it. Yeah. He's certainly got that wild eyed crazy man thing going on. Who plays Jane?
I mean, if it was 10 years ago, I would say Mila Jovovich. She would be perfect for that.
Yeah.
But I think she's mostly done with doing the action movies now. Cause I think that the last Resident Evil was like the culmination of doing this.
I think it takes it out of you after a while.
Charlize Theron. She's been doing a lot more action lately. And she's
signed me up.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Yeah. Have you guys seen that Old Guard movie?
That was fun.
Is it good?
I watched that like 10 times. Oh, it's so good. Yeah.
I could see like Margot Robbie doing something interesting with it.
Yeah. She's funny. She could, they could bring some humor. Yeah.
You know who's real funny though? Justin Long.
Yeah.
True. It's very.
Not intentionally though.
No, it's not on purpose.
It's just, not funny. Haha.
Like, who would be Ralphie? Like, you need to have somebody that can the inevitable betrayer.
Christoph Waltz.
Oh yeah, that would
just
be.
Go for it.
You'd be just giggling half the time.
Yeah, I like it. And the Henry Rollins role, I'm sure Henry would want to
just get Henry Rollins again. Yeah, he's like, yeah. He'll be like J. Jonah Jameson. Like, you got same guy every time.
Henry Rollins is one of my favorite surreal LA experiences because I ran into him in Trader Joe's, and like, and it was very much the you know, you're in Trader Joe's, so you're disassociating, right? Like, you're just focused on the food. You forget there's other human beings there, as you do. And I just bumped into this dude, and he turns around, and it's Henry. Like, he's just a dude in a black t-shirt and jeans, but he turns around and he's Henry Rollins. And so I had this very quick succession of like, oh, I'm sorry. Oh shit, that's Henry Rollins. What do I say to Henry? He looks pissed. I should just go. But I think that's also just kind of his default expression.
I would think so. Also, you have to be a solid 10 inches taller than he is.
Yeah.
I'm guessing. I've never seen him in person, but I don't think he's much taller than I am. He's quite a lot larger than I am, but I don't think he's very big, very tall. But this is a 95 was a hell of a year for Henry Rollins. He had this and then Heat, where, you know, 6 months later, Heat comes out right after this.
It's amazing that those two movies were made in the same year. Like, Heat,
they don't even seem like they're from the same decade.
Yeah.
No, Heat feels more modern than Johnny Mnemonic right now.
Oh my God, yeah. And we talked about it like in the, as we were getting ready for this, there's the character in Heat, Kelso, who's like the guy that gets all the schematics for the for one of the jobs that De Niro's crew is doing. And, you know, that famous scene where De Niro goes up to his house on the hillside in LA and is like, where do you get this stuff from? He's like, it just floats through the air. You just got to know how to grab it. You know, clearly talking about, you know, stealing stuff online, which is, you know, in 95, not a lot of people were checking for that kind of stuff. Nobody really knew what the hell was going on online. And that, you know, IP theft was a thing, and that people were doing this kind of reconnaissance. But that Johnny Mnemonic, I knew it.
Man, we're so close.
God, we made it almost the whole
clean sheet, too. Ah, it does feel like an 80s movie in so many ways. And whereas Heat could have been made last year, you know, aside from like the payphone scenes and stuff like that.
Well, when you get the cinematographer of Weekend at Bernie's, you're gonna end up with a made for TV movie.
Yeah, they swung big on the cast, and then they
like, shit, we got to make this too.
Right.
Who's gonna write down the DP? The memory transfer setup was a calculator, a mini disc player and disc, a knockoff iPhone, a cigarette pack, and some cables and a mouth guard.
Yeah.
It was pretty wild.
It was, what were the glasses for? He like wore, it was like they were injecting it through his eyes, but then also through the plug in his head, or were the goggles just to like keep it together, keep him in a trance or something?
I think that's the way that I thought it, like the VR goggles or whatever they were supposed to be was like the way to disassociate him from real, you know, like in a Trader Joe's.
That's exactly
kind of like, yeah. So, all right. What else? Did we hit everything? I think we did. We got it all.
There's not much. I mean, it's a great, you know, diorama of stagecraft, grungy techno babble, like a lot of patina on your zip discs and stuff. But
yeah,
other than that, let's wait for the remake. Don't bother watching Johnny Mnemonic, everybody. To everybody still listening to this. Mom,
it's an entertaining 90 minutes, I think. Like, sure, you know, sure. If you need to cut yourself off from reality for an hour and a half,
come for iced tea, stay for the Junkie Dolphin.
There's a tagline.
As always, Pete wraps it up nicely at the end. Yeah. All right, you guys. Thanks as always. This is good times.
Don't forget to vote. Or shit.
Yeah,
that's all right.
Okay. We'll do Back to the Future next, and we can fix it in post.
Yes. Nice.
Yes. All right, you guys. Talk to you soon.
You too.
Bye. Later.